You're listening to Face Off, episode 35, recorded September 13th, 2009. Face Off! Welcome to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And I'm Mark Sanborn.
And in this podcast, we like to talk about various aspects of web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, you can view our show notes by going to faceoffshow.com or follow us by going to twitter.com/faceoffshow.
What is in the news today? What do we got?
Well, actually, I want to ask you a question. This is kind of a random thing. I want to ask you a question. What's the object-oriented way to become wealthy? Inheritance, you dummy. Wow.
Awesome.
Cheesy. Okay, so let's get into our news and follow-ups, because that stuff is not funny. Our first follow-up this week actually involves PodShifter, which we talked about in episode 23, which was a web service that allowed you to put in an RSS feed for a podcast, and then you could speed it up using various levels. And what it did, what was really nice, is it spit out an RSS feedback so you could subscribe to that RSS feed, and all podcasts for that series would then be shifted to whatever speed you set. But this is a little old news that we kind of found out about. In the new iPod Touch and iPhone 3.0 update, they actually have it built in to speed up your podcast in the device itself.
Yeah, that's great, because you know, PodShifter was great and I could, you know, change my levels and everything, but it would kind of take a little while. It had to go fetch everything, and you know, once you had it set up, you know,
every podcast you want to shift, you have to go into PodShifter. But it was a great service. Without doubt.
This is awesome because it's built in. Any podcast that you download, you know, through the iTunes or whatever, is ready to go. You know, it's got the shifting. The only downside, I guess, is you only have one speed that you can increase to. You have normal speed, two times the speed, and then a half speed.
Ooh. So it can slow it down for you if you want
it? Yeah, it can slow it down. It can do normal and then double the speed, which is quite fast.
Is it for all pod? You just set it as a setting for all podcasts or per podcast?
It's kind of like a volume control. You can click it.
Oh, okay. You know. Okay. So while you're listening to it.
Pretty easy. Yep. Awesome. So yeah, if you want to slow it down while you're doing your podcast, you can do that. I still like PodShifter though, because you can set it to, like, let's say 1.6 times the speed or 1.4. Mm-hmm.
Or there, I mean, arguably the iPod is the most popular MP3 player on the market, but
other ones,
like, you know, I use the Zune. I'm a Zune guy myself, so
that's a good point. You can't use an iPhone feature on it.
That's true.
1.6, yeah. So you have a little bit more control. So
yeah, like, but you found that 2 times the speed was a little too fast for something.
Depending on the content, yeah.
Yeah, I remember when we were playing with PodShifter, I thought that 2 times was too fast for most things for me.
Yeah.
I liked, you know, about 1.5.
Well, yeah, 1.6.
Enough that you could notice that it was faster, but it didn't become unreadable or garble it too much.
It does do a decent job, though. I mean, it doesn't sound chipmunky.
That's good, because that's
Alvin and the Chipmunk style.
That was, did you listen to that at Christmas time?
Oh, yeah.
My parents had that LP, and we listened to it a lot.
Well, I mean, it was always on the radio. I mean, it was always on the radio.
Time is, yeah, totally.
It's terrible, is what it was.
No, if I have kids, they're going to listen to Alvin and the Chipmunks come Christmas time.
I feel sorry for them. So, that's pretty much it.
That's good. I mean, I say this a lot, but it seems more and more, like the Zune, people will call me a Zune fanboy and probably hate me for this, but both these players, I think, have been borrowing a lot from each other. The new iTunes update seems to borrow a little heavily from the sort of Zune interface for the software. So I'm hoping that as these players get more competitive, we'll see a lot more stuff like that. So, for example, if the iPod implements this sort of feature, hopefully in the next couple iterations of the Zune, we'll see it, because it'd be nice to have that.
Yeah, I mean, it'd also be nice to if I or Apple put this in as kind of a test, like, do people actually use this feature? And then maybe they find out people use it, and maybe they can do 1.6 times the speed or something like that. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, because it's just a matter of, like, processing speed.
Yeah, I mean,
really,
why,
it's not.
Why can't, if they can do 2 times, why can't they do 1.5 times?
Exactly. You know? So cool. But that's great. Like we talked about, we use podcasts and audiobooks a lot, and we, you know, like my audiobooks, I speed up so that
you can listen to twice the content.
Yeah, it's, I mean, you're able. And this again, we've talked about bro science before. This is bro science, but I've heard it's just you can interpret information a lot better audibly than visually. Mm-hmm. I don't know about quality of how well you can maybe reference that information later, but you definitely could. I definitely can listen to a chapter in an audiobook sped up. Let's say 5 minutes of audio content, I can get a lot more and retain better than 5 minutes of reading. Mm-hmm. I'm just not a fast reader. So I'm fast. This is really funny, actually, I found with reading. I can read really fast, as in I can read every word, but I can't really soak it in fast. I can't comprehend it fast. So during school, I would read every chapter they would assign, read this chapter, and I would read it in, a half an hour. And then I would get done and be like, all right. And this is when I first started to realize that I was having problems. I would say, what happened in that chapter? Oh, crud. So anyways, big tangent there. Let's get into our web apps. The first web app we have is called WishSpot.
WishSpot is kind of like Wishmere that we talked about. This is like, a universal wish list. So like Amazon has a wish list feature. You can go on Amazon, you can add some things to your cart, then you can give them to, let's say, your parents at Christmas time or a friend or whatever and say, hey, here's some things that I'm interested in. If you want to make your life easier, just go here and pick something and give it to me.
Yeah.
But that's just Amazon. What if you want something from like ThinkGeek or like?
Yeah, I don't want to spend 12 different. I don't want to send 12 different wish list URLs to my family.
Yeah, you just.
I personally stick to ThinkGeek and Amazon because Amazon is kind of the kitchen sink. It has everything.
It has a lot.
And ThinkGeek has a lot of stuff that I really do personally enjoy, but that's a pain. And I don't know. Are you a wish list guy? Both. I mean, there's buying and receiving. Are you a wish list person?
Yeah, I like it. I mean, I haven't. I want to try it. Like, I haven't actually done it yet. Mm-hmm. Like, say, here's a wish list.
See, I love wish lists because for myself, because people are always like, Jade, what do we get you? Jade, what do we get you? And I don't remember this. And all I remember is I just add stuff to my wish list when I'm surfing around on the internet. Mm-hmm. And it's there's just certain things, certain items I'm very particular about, like electronics. I want what I want when it comes to electronics. I don't want something kind of like it. And no one in my family is really that geeky or that electronic-y to get me to figure out that that's what I want. Mm-hmm. So like sometimes I'm like, oh, we got you a new keyboard. And you're like, oh, that's kind of like what I wanted. But I'm very picky about this sort of stuff. So
or you liked something maybe back in the sixth grade and your grandma's still getting you the same genre of stuff.
You sound like you're speaking from experience, Mark.
Yes, I know. Not necessarily, yeah.
But okay. Or it works really well. Like for my family, my parents will call me and say, "Hey, Amber, who is my wife? Amber's birthday is coming up. What should we get her?" And I'm like, I don't know. If I went to a store with my parents, I could point out stuff that Amber would like.
And some people might say, "Well, that what's the whole point of getting a gift? Is like, I don't want to just pick something off the list." But actually, if you look at the list, you can kind of infer some of the items you might be interested in. You don't have to get something on the list. It's just a good way to get like a snapshot of what those kinds of things they like. And you might get something that's totally different off the list and they might love it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like I said, I'm picky about electronics, but other things like kitchen gadgets and stuff, I'm really not. I'll take any sort of kitchen gadget. I love them. They're fun. Mm-hmm. And you could infer that by going to my wish list.
Yep.
So that being in mind, go to Amazon.com. Search for Jade Robbins if you want to buy me
some cool stuff. So in episode 21, we talked about Wishmere, and this Wishpot is basically the same thing. Mm-hmm. It's got like a little bookmarklet. You can manually add something and just throw a URL in to buy where to purchase it. It's a universal wish list.
I remember going to Wishlist though, or Wishmere, and going kind of like, well, this interface seems a little clunky. I remember it just didn't click. The concept I really liked. Conceptually, I was like, this is what I want, but the interface never really clicked with me. Wishpot, I felt much more standardized. It seems normal. I didn't have to think about what was going on as much.
Yeah.
You just add items. And so this is great because you can add items you just from any website. You just put in the URL. Even if when you search for an item, it searches for the database of items that people have already added. But if they don't have it, you can still add it yourself. Like, we were looking at Chumbies, and the only Chumbie that was added was a specific color, like cardinal.
Right. But you could always do a manual.
If I wanted to, I could just go add the regular latte Chumbie, which is, the color I would take.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's also public versus private. So if you want to get, like, an anniversary gift versus Christmas.
Or whatever. You can do baby or wedding registries on it as well, which is nice because so like when for a lot of weddings, you go you pick your ponies. Like for Amber and I's wedding, we said okay, Target and actually we did Amazon, Target and Amazon, and so then, but with this we could do a wedding registry all over the place.
Yeah,
which is great.
Yeah. Yeah, why would limit yourself to just Target and Walmart?
Yeah.
Or Target and Amazon.
Yep. So check it out, wishpot.com.
All right, so the next web app we got is Twitter Snooze.
All right, so Twitter Snooze, this this happens a lot. We follow a lot of people. I follow a lot of celebrities. I follow a lot of local people. And what you find with these celebrities is there's a lot of good tech people that I just like just for their overall sort of view on the tech industry and stuff. But there's some of them do things that I don't like. I'm really not a huge Apple fan. I have Apple products. I really don't get revved up about Apple stuff. So anytime there's an Apple event, half of these Silicon Valley celebrities go to it and they're talking about the latest keynote from the Apple event for, you know, an entire day or 2 days. And it just, it clutters up your Twitter stream. This app, what it does is you put in your Twitter username and your Twitter password, which we don't like. I wish they really would move to OAuth.
OAuth, yep.
And then you put in the Twitter username of the person you want to snooze and how long you want to snooze them. And then you can also announce the snooze to Twitter and you hit submit. And what it does is unfollows them for a specific amount of time. Like if you pick 1 day or 1 week, you know, let's say you're like, oh, the Apple keynote's coming up. I'm going to snooze this person for a couple days so I don't have to hear about it. And then after that time period comes up, they refollow them for you. And if you announce it, it's kind of a nice way to tell them, like, so, you know, you always worry about this. Like sometimes you unfollow someone because they're, you know, maybe tweeting tweeting in an annoying way. So you unfollow them.
I can give you an example, actually. Recently, I unfollowed somebody that tweeted 16 times in a row. And I was like, I can't be following somebody like that. I mean, it kind of bugs me.
Yeah.
And then I kind of felt bad for it because then he replied me like a few minutes later. He must have saw that I unfollowed him or something.
Yeah.
But he replied to me about something else. So I felt bad and then followed him back again. But if I had something like this, I could say, hey, you know, I don't really like it when you tweet something like 16 times in a row and within 5 minutes. So I'm snoozing you for a day or two.
Yeah. It lets them know that you're snoozing. You're not unfollowing them. It's not, it's supposed to do it in a non-disrespectful way. That's the whole point of it. And I hope that it's realized that because it's not trying to be a jerk. I'm just trying to say, hey, I'm just going to unfollow you while you're doing this because I need you to clear out my
stream. Can you snooze without them knowing?
Yes.
I mean, if you follow somebody and they have email alerts on, though, they get
an email. They will, though. Yes, they will get a re-notification that you.
But you don't have to say, hey, you're a jerk. I'm snoozing you for a day.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. So that's cool.
Yeah, the tagline is also really funny because it says, hit the snooze button on your, quote, verbose, quote, Twitter friends.
So I thought this was interesting. At the bottom, I clicked on the link of this. It said this idea was inspired by Merlin Mann post, and I checked it out. He's the guy that does 43 folders.
Yeah.
And they're saying, you know, like his blog was about, like, you know, some of these social media sites need a snooze, like, great. For a while, you know?
So yeah.
It was pretty cool.
I wish I had a snooze on everything. Sometimes, so I could just snooze for 8 hours, and I couldn't go to Twitter, I couldn't go to Facebook, really crank on some work, but hey, man, there's an idea. I said it first. Give me credit.
I snooze my alarm too much.
Yeah, me too. All right, our next web app that we're going to talk about is called iNumber.
iNumber is kind of like, you know, Google Voice, where you get this temporary number, but you don't have all the features of Google Voice. It's not a permanent number. It's like, this is perfect for like
Craigslist. It's meant to be a temporary
number. Or something like let's put out this temporary number that's going to last a week and then do it with what?
So let's say I'm putting something up on Craigslist and I want people to call me for information if they want to buy it or if they just want more information. But I don't want to put out my actual phone number out there. I don't want a bunch of random people calling my actual number. You could put out your Google Voice number.
You could, yeah.
But then you still have your Google Voice number hanging out there, and someone might accidentally put it, you know, they might put it in their phone book as like Jade selling the motorcycle and then pocket dial you or something in the future. After your specified amount of time with iNumber, that phone number doesn't go to your number anymore. It doesn't work.
And I read through their FAQs. They're pretty unique numbers. Like they're saying the chances of somebody else getting your number and all that is like very, very low.
Yeah.
And they also, I mean, we tried it out. It worked pretty well, actually.
It works great,
and I mean, the caller ID, what did it come through when I called you?
It came up as your number,
so
which is really surprising.
It's kind of like Google Voice. So it forwards over the number.
Exactly. And what it does is it gives you a number you can pick a number from a bunch of bigger cities. Obviously places like, you know, Bozeman, Montana are not in that list, mm-hmm. but you could do like Seattle, is what I picked. And then it gives you a number in that locality, and then it's an extension. And you call up and you put in your extension and you wait, and it tells me,
it's got the greeting.
Yeah, it tells me who's calling me. Like Mark had you had to record and say, hey, this is Mark. And then when I hit it, it's like, this is Mark is calling. Right. Do you want to answer or other options? Just hit one to answer, and there you go.
So
you also know when someone is calling from that number. True. It's not just a phone. It's not just a call that comes up. It's letting you
know. They have to announce who they are and what they're calling about.
Yeah.
And then you can decide whether or not to take it.
Yeah. And in your head, you go, okay, this is an I number call.
So if you want something that's super fast and easy, disposable number, kind of like a disposable email or something, this is it.
Yeah. Great way to do it.
Great way. Because, and it's not in beta or anything. You can just go and use it.
I mean, we talk about disposable emails, disposable credit cards a lot, disposable passwords. Mm-hmm. And they're pretty useful because sometimes you don't want to be sticking your actual information, just hanging, even like a phone number. It's kind of like, but I just don't want people calling my cell phone number.
I can imagine Craigslist if you actually put your real number, I can imagine the spam, telemarketing calls you get.
It's a greasy place. It's like the back alley of the internet. Yeah. It's really useful, but it's also really greasy.
Yeah. So this is perfect for something like that.
Definitely. All right. I want to remind you guys that if you have a follow-up that we need to correct, or just some information, or a web app that you want us to check out, go to faceoffshow.com/feedback and let us know, and we'll take a look at it.
All right. So we're going to jump into our topics. The first one we got is kind of a really cool one, I think. Signs that you're a bad programmer.
I don't know if I want to do this one, Mark.
You don't?
Because afraid? I think I'm going to qualify for a couple of these.
Well, the good news is if you do qualify, it gives you some remedies on how to kind of fix it up.
Wow.
Become a better programmer.
That's good. I like that.
The first one we've got is number one, inability to reason about code. So some examples or symptoms of this is kind of like the voodoo code. Like you know, you start coding, you get some variables going, and then you add another function, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh, I don't need this little piece anymore. And then you leave that variable code in and it's just, you leave it in there and it doesn't actually do anything.
Yeah. There's some other great examples here, like bulldozer code, which is code that gives the appearance of refactoring by breaking out chunks into subroutines that are impossible to reuse in any other context of the application. That's not a good way to do it. You need to, just breaking it up is not refactoring.
I like this one. Executing functions multiple times, like calling the save function multiple times just to be sure.
Just to be sure.
Just to be sure that's save. Let's do it three times.
So,
this is a good one too. Yo-yo code where you have like a variable and then you switch it to, like, let's say it's a decimal and then you switch it back to a string and then back to a number, then back to a decimal. And
I think I've done that a couple times. Yeah. I don't want to admit it, but yeah. So how do I fix this? I mean, what do I do?
Well, I mean, some of the ways is just kind of recognize that you probably shouldn't leave variables that you don't use anymore laying around in the code. When you're refactoring, you got to say, am I going to be able to reuse this, or am I going to reuse this if I break it into a smaller piece? Is it useful that small of a piece? You can also use like IDEs and step through the code and see what is actually getting done.
Like looking at your variables as you step through it, and you're like, wow, this one never gets changed again or even accessed. I should probably get rid of it.
Mm-hmm. That's about it.
Great. So make sure that you can reason about your code. Number two is understanding of the language's programming model. And this involves, as far as I understand it, sort of looking at, you know, like Ruby is object oriented. 100%. Mm-hmm. Everything is an object. It gets kind of hairy in things like PHP, where it's pretty much a procedural language. Right. Where they've kind of glued in OOP stuff with it. But I assume a lot of this means, like, you know, don't, if something doesn't functionally represent an object, don't make it an object just because you feel like you need to be doing OOP.
Right. And like assembly, it goes from top from bottom, you know, they have to use go to statements, but like in PHP, you probably wouldn't use that.
Yeah.
You know, they look down upon that kind of stuff.
Okay. So, I mean, how do I fix this? Do I just know my language better? Is that looking at best practice code of, you know, examples in this language? Like if I decided that I wanted to really figure out the best way to use PHP, in my head, I would look at like WordPress.
I think it's, that'd be a good one, good way to do it. Also, like if you're coding, I mean, PHP can be coded either object-oriented or procedural, and kind of stick with that, at least in that section of code. Like, you might have this piece of code all object-oriented, and then you've got your kind of template view area where you're doing procedural.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know.
It's, okay. Yeah, I think another great place to look at, if you want to look at how people are kind of doing things, is go to something like GitHub.
Mm-hmm.
And look at, you know, for example, I posted I think it's Gist, which is like the basically GitHub's version of, you know, Pastebin.
Mm-hmm.
And people can like fork it and change it and stuff. And I did that. And Paul Levet, a guy on our show, looked at my code and he actually forked it and cleaned it up where I had sort of had redundant code, and he made sort of a good function out of that because it did fit as a generic piece of code that could be used in the whole application.
Mm-hmm.
So check it out. Number three is you have deficient research skills or chronically poor knowledge of the platform's features.
So this one's all about, you know, I'm not a very strong PHP programmer, but I'm using like Cake PHP or something, yeah, and I'm using all these features, but I don't really understand how they're working underneath.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
we're not being able to research it. I mean, to be a really good programmer, you need to be able to jump into, you know, a program's API or its documentation and be able to kind of chunk it out. I've noticed that my ability to do this has really gotten a lot better in the future, because in the past I would get in and I would be like, it's looking for a string, and once mm-hmm. you got to do that a lot. And if you really can't figure it out, then ask someone. But once you get the solution, look at that documentation and say, okay, this is what, you know, like I go to like Paul at work. I would say, okay, Paul told me this, how this works. How does that fit in this documentation? Oh, okay. You know, and it's really hard with Ruby, especially because it's this metaprogramming language with some really goofy stuff to make it look like natural language and not code.
Mm-hmm. So an example of this would be like maybe the framework might have a way to validate email addresses. Why would you make your own regular expression for it? Why reinvent some of the classes or stuff, something that the framework already contains? So it can kind of go both ways. The class might also have something that's overkill for what you're trying to do. And you probably should make a little, your own simpler version.
Yeah. If you're doing just a bunch of hardcore stuff to validate an email address, which, you know, you don't always have to.
Part of the researching is, you know, don't be going on forums and posting like, email me the code, please. You know, if somebody's trying to help you out, it's kind of like, here's the solution's not going to help you as much as getting to the solution.
Yeah, like we were talking about before, if someone does give you the solution, figure out why and how they did it. Also, if you're helping people, don't just give them a free lunch. Mm-hmm. We talked about this. Sometimes you go into these coding forums and people will get really angry because they feel like they're doing their homework for you. So try and work with that and try and understand how they're helping you and how their solution actually does it for you.
Yeah. Also, I mean, get out of your comfort zone a little bit, do a little bit the newer kind of stuff, try it out, see how it works. Don't always just stick with the really old technique that you're already used to. Yeah. You know, I used to see like HTML pages were all still capitalized and things because that's the way they used to do it. And,
well, a lot, and you've really been learning a lot of new languages lately. I wouldn't say becoming experts in all these languages, but you're like, mm-hmm. I remember you were like, I want to try Perl. So you did a couple little small programs in Perl. You were like, I want to learn Python. You did some programs in Python, and that really helps you out to break out
and
do that, because it's not something you know, it's something you have to figure out, and that's really important if you want to be a good programmer.
Yep. Number four is the inability to comprehend pointers.
Oh, man. Pointers are tough. I remember this. I'm not, especially in the sort of web programming world, you don't run into pointers a whole lot, but the concept is really important to remember.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of depends on the language. Some of them copy the value into a new piece of memory, and some of them just point back to the mm-hmm. same piece. And, you know, they're giving an example here where you guys check into a hotel room and Joe wants to know where Chris is staying in, and he asks Bill where he's at, and Bill says, I don't know, I think Sally knows, and you got to go all over the place looking for his phone number. And
yeah, there's like linked list, there's like reverse linked list, there's like double linked list. It gets intense. But I mean, yeah, you need to sort of understand this concept, because especially if you're not doing, like I said, web programming, if you're doing stuff like I used them in Java back in school, and you can get some really cool stuff to print out when you just start printing, you know, random chunks of the RAM that a pointer is pointing to.
Definitely. The next one we got is difficulty seeing through recursion.
Recursion is one of those concepts that is just really cool, and I think you have to be really articulate and good to use it properly.
Yeah, some of the most complex things, like some complex algorithm can be solved, you know, easily with a simple loop or a for each.
Yeah, exactly. And understanding sort of time complexity and things like that, sometimes you can really save. It sounds weird, but you can save a lot of time complexity by using recursion. So I mean, how do you learn recursion? I mean, how would you go about that?
You know, you could step through. That always helps. You know, if you've got an IDE and you want to go loop through and see when it exits the loop. And
mm-hmm. I had a coworker who loved recursion. I mean, he did so much stuff in recursion to the point of ridiculousness sometimes.
Really?
Because the thing is about recursion is you have to write fairly broad generic code.
True.
You know, for it to be applicable to every sort of subchild that's calling itself, it's kind of difficult.
Yeah.
And always figuring out how to stop the recursion loop, because you'll get into a lot of infinite loops, I found, when I was messing around with recursion. So it's always hard to be like, okay, so this is what happens. This is the stop condition. And then how do I sort of, how do I have that trickle all the way back through to the original call that then called all the recursive functions from there?
Yeah, I think every programmer has made themselves a little endless loop while one.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. All right. So here are signs that you are a mediocre programmer. I think I'll probably fit this category, to be honest with you. So, all right. So the first sign that you are a mediocre programmer, and this may be a sign that maybe I'm a mediocre programmer, because like the first one I had to really kind of think about it, but I'm starting to understand it, is the inability to think in sets. And what I'm getting from this is sort of a really good example that most people understand would be things like distributed computing or multiple cores. You know, this application working as a whole, but it's sort of chunked out in an ability to give operations to different places that then come back again in the end to give you sort of a full functional thing.
So not just the individual units, but actually the system as a whole, all the sets working together.
Yeah, exactly. And so, like, let's say if we took any one of our programs, which you don't see this in the web a lot. So, I mean, this is kind of a generic programming article. It's not about, web programming. Would be things like, okay, making sure my operations are separate enough that I could scale with them, right? Can you chunk these out to different places and farm them out to a different server so that they can scale and work together, instead of just having kind of this big conglomerate program working together? Like, what chunks can you do out in sets that, like the great example is a person shuffling cards. The whole process is shuffling a deck of cards, but the operation is handled by two different hands and two different thumbs.
Right.
But together, you get the operation of shuffling a deck of cards. But the sort of operations are handed off into two different sets. I could shuffle a deck of cards with one hand by like smushing them around on a table and then kind of bringing it together and stuff.
Right.
But it's much more efficient to be able to separate them up into two sets to make one operation.
Yeah. And to way to, kind of the remedy or the way to visualize some of this stuff, they give some examples for like parallel processing. Think of like a freeway traffic passing through an array of toll booths.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
So you don't have just one line of people. You have five lines of people.
Yeah.
Let's say. Or you can think of like a simple join, like a zipper tag on a jacket, pulling up the zipper teeth together and joining the two objects together.
Yeah, exactly. That's where I got, they gave the example of shuffling a deck of cards, which really worked for me. But I also think about it a lot because I work on a university where we do a lot of distributed computing and trying to think of how you take these big operations and making sure that they're able to be, sent off to different machines, but still be useful and come back together into the whole operation as one.
The next one we have is lack of critical thinking. Critical thinking is critical in
programming. It's very critical.
It really is, though. I mean, sometimes you'll be thinking and be like, oh, man, I have this idea for this function, and you start writing and be like, man, that was just not even close. Yeah. There's a way better way to do this. And sometimes you got to think about it before you just start getting in there and coding. And
Yeah, and being able to really shove these initial thoughts that come into your head like, oh, I can't do it that way. Oh, it can't be done. Really, really think about it. This is where it's really helpful to have, for example, a guest we had on the show, Eric Wendelin, earlier was wrote an article about how to connect with other programmers via Twitter. Mm-hmm. And although I don't do it as much with Twitter, working with these amazing programmers that I work with in my job really has helped me out a lot, because there's times where I'm just like, oh, man, there's no way to do that. And they're like, mm-hmm. well, no, let's let's really crunch your head on this and see what you can do, because I can bet you it's possible. And, you know, you start talking with them and all of a sudden you come up with a solution and it's amazing and it's something you never would have thought. But, you know, you need to have that ability to say
the box a little bit.
Exactly.
A symptom of this would be like the man in the man with a hammer mentality. Everything can be solved with this tool.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, exactly. It's unfortunate. I really get into that rut a lot. So it's good. I'm getting better, like I said, working with really creative people that don't take my bullheadedness, because that's the hard part. Sometimes, you know, these other guys that are really good critical thinkers, it's a lot easier for them to just say, fine, go do it your way and screw up and then I'll look better, you know. But it's nice when you have these people that will tell you, say, hey, you know, you're definitely selling this problem short. Mm-hmm. You need to think about it more. There's a book here that the article mentions that I want to read too, called Critical Thinking by Paul and Elder, which apparently is supposed to be a really good one that we're going to have to check out later.
Yeah, you know, generally try to think outside the box and try not to restrict your thinking into, well, this tool you worked in the past, and I think it'll probably work here too. Might not be the best tool.
Absolutely. Number three is pinball programming.
So pinball programming, this is the one where, you know, you program the program, and while you're doing it, you know, if you tip the pinball machine a certain way and you, like, you pull the lever back this far, it'll work.
Yeah.
But if you don't do it that exact way, it breaks.
Yeah.
I kind of do this sometimes.
You just
program just to get the first little thing working.
Yeah.
And then, oh, I got it working.
You hear this a lot. Yeah, it works. And it's not pretty, but it works.
Let's move on to the next little feature or something. And it works, but it only works in, like, this little special way, you know?
It's very, that sort of code is very maintenance heavy. It's very easy. It's really easy to break because it is so specific.
One of the symptoms here is, like, you have one try catch block at the beginning or wrapping the entire main function, you know. It's very easily breakable. Yeah. It's mainly, I mean, it's just basically a rough draft first time thing. And make sure your code is polished before you move on to the next feature. Yeah, I would say.
The next one, number four, is unfamiliar with the principles of security. And this is tough.
Yeah, this
I think it's really hard to stay super familiar with security, but I think if you start doing it, then you really get into it a lot more.
It's halfway out of the scope of programming, but it's still, at the same time, the programmers are the only ones that are going to be making this code, so they have to almost know the security behind it. So some of the symptoms: don't be storing passwords or credit card numbers in plain text. We've talked about this before. At the very least, hash it. And even then, you know, if you're not using a salt, you're still not adhering to the security principles. You know, make sure you're not allowing SQL injections and things like that.
I mean, how do you fix this?
I would almost kind of learn how the hackers hack, how code gets broken. Overflow buffer run or buffer over. I totally
overflow buffer runs.
Buffer overflow runs. SQL injections, cross-site scripting.
I mean, you and I learned a lot when I wrote an application once that broke and you were helping me kind of debug it. I mean, we found a lot of these bugs and we're testing it on that actual website and going, holy cow, it's amazing what you can do when you're not sanitizing the input of your application.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, so now I'm really sensitive to that sort of thing.
One of the basic principles of security is the more simplistic your application is, the easier it is to secure. So that could be one of the things you could strive for. Another thing is don't compile in your key into your program to decrypt. Like, let's say if you're encrypting something, read up about some security features and flaws.
This article also mentions, if you can, always have a security professional review the design and implementation. Just because it's one of those things, you know, more eyes, these guys are professionals at it. If you don't have a security professional, use one of your programmers that's, you know, one of your friends or something that's more security minded. You get into security quite a bit, so I always have you kind of review and check my stuff. I bounce ideas off you, and you throw them back if you think there's a security concern. So, you know, try and discuss it as much as you can.
And avoid obfuscation. I mean, there's a lot of companies that are, you know, saying, well, if people don't know about it, it's going to be tough for them to, you know, like GSM, the telephone technology, is now hacked because of the obfuscation, and it was an older technology.
Yeah.
But
Yeah. Don't trust it.
Don't rely on
don't
that.
Don't trust it. Yeah, exactly.
And if it's appropriate, open source it and let some more eyeballs check it out.
That's a great one. Yeah, exactly. I'm a big fan of open source for that reason. Some people disagree, but I think that's the best way, is because people, you'd be surprised what programmers will do for fun in their spare time. Like, look at your code. Like Paul, I was talking about, you know, Paul Levette. That man is an animal. He is always looking at code. He looks at everything. He's genius.
So this is a fun part of the segment. Signs that you should not be a programmer.
If I was mean, I definitely have some people I would send this article to, because there's some things. The first is an inability to determine the order of program execution.
So their example here, they've got A equals 5, B equals 10, A equals B. What number should it be? And if you don't know, maybe you should become an electrician or a plumber or an architect.
What's going to print out, Mark?
It's going to be 10. Depending on the programming language, I bet.
Actually, I think it does depend on the programming language. Okay. Number two is insufficient ability to think abstractly.
So, you know, regular expressions, things like that they're kind of hard to understand at first. So you got to be able to think abstractly.
Yeah, this a great example of this is that thing, that gist I was talking about earlier. What I did, what it is, I guess I should explain it. It was a way to update your DreamHost DNS on your own computer. It's a Ruby script, and the DreamHost API is all GET calls. And so what I did is I hard coded basically the address of each GET call that I was doing in my program. Well, Paul looked at my program and he said, "Well, you're just making simple GET requests in each of these. Why not just make a generic function to handle the request that would be smart enough to take all the different kinds you'd be doing in this application? And then you just have one spot to fix, you know, if you have to ever fix your GET request or anything like that." That's good abstract thinking.
The next one is caller brothers syndrome. You know, the unwilling to delete some of your code or some of your comments or throw anything away. I fall into this.
You
somewhat.
Are an electronic pack rat.
I know.
You have stuff
like, I'm
from
afraid I'm
going
to need to use this little piece of code. So I'll like comment it out and then like leave it there for like a month and then come back and maybe delete it.
I hate that. When you go through someone's stuff and everything is commented out.
Yeah.
If you're using source code management, this shouldn't be a problem. That's should be able to go back to it. If you're using Git or, you know, Subversion, you can go check the diff on those versions when it changed.
The other thing they mention here is, you know, poor organization skills or the unwillingness to communicate with other programmers and things.
That
is a big deal.
That is a big deal. That's a sign you shouldn't be a programmer, because sometimes I've had some discussions at work where, you know, like I work with some really good programmers who really try and strive for best practices. And there's been times that we've talked to some programmers and we kind of tell them about, you know, the best practice way to do this. And they look at us and they're like, no, that's not the way I want to do it. And you're like, well, trust me, the entire group of programmers that care about this, you know, interested, good programmers are not wrong. They have done this enough that they know that that's why it's called a best practice. And it's really frustrating, because sometimes you think when you're talking to these people, you can tell that they're uncomfortable, I think, because they feel completely inferior. But a good programmer should be able to say, no, these guys are good programmers and I need to learn as much as I can from them.
Mm-hmm. The next one is dysfunctional sense of causality. You know, when your program is broken, you know, don't rely on some, you know, variable that was missing, or don't they give an example here where like rituals, your debugging rituals include like rubbing your lucky golf ball or twisting your wedding ring.
Yeah. Yeah, it shouldn't be voodoo. It shouldn't be you don't know what's going on. You should be able to, and you need to have this mentality that you say, I can go in and I can dig into this and find out where it's going wrong. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't be just kind of like a crapshoot. Like
I got to reboot my computer and it'll work then.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Yeah, it should not be that.
Alternative.
There are times, I mean, if you are a good programmer where you say, okay, I think that there, you know, this update may have broken something. I need to restart my computer. But I know a lot of people, and I've been one of them in the past, where you just assume that a reboot's going to fix every programming error. And you're like,
Speaking of rebooting, the next one, indifference to outcomes. You know, if you aren't interested in fixing a bug that, you know, that requires a computer fix, that maybe you shouldn't be a programmer.
Yeah. So, make sure, again, this was an article designed for programmers, which, you know, which I look at as people, let's say, who I did not graduate with a computer science degree,
right?
A software engineering degree. You know, I'm not super advanced. Some of our listeners to the show are, and some of them are on the other side of the spectrum, even more so than me or you. So, use this. If you're a good programmer, or a real professional programmer, look at this list and say, okay, am I doing these things or not? If you're a novice programmer, you know, look at some of this, glaze over the technical details, and you really get the gist is that you need to be more open-minded. You can't be closed-minded. You need to think about what's happening.
Yeah, I mean, just because your program works and it produces the right output doesn't mean you might want to go in there and, like, you know, if you, for the symptoms, for an example here, they say if you don't use white space or indention, you know, you probably should go in there and check that out, you know. Yeah. Just because your program might work, but it might just look terrible to another programmer, and it might, you know, decrease in productivity if other people are working on it.
Yeah, it's actually interesting. A lot of the stuff I've learned about programming has just been hanging around really good programmers. When I went to school, you know, I went for business management, but where I worked and a lot of the groups of friends that I hung out with were all computer science people. And so we would go out to lunch and they would talk about it. And I really soaked up a lot just from being around those guys who really knew what they were doing and knew what they were talking about. So that sort of stuff always helps as well. All right, let's get into our next topic, which is a listing of different types of unusual computer bugs. We talked about this a little bit last week.
The time bugs, the time sensitive ones, where, like, his daylight savings times breaks the app.
Yeah, exactly. Can you print on Tuesdays?
Yeah, we're gonna learn about that type of bug here, and they actually have formal names. So the first one is the Heisen bug. So this is a bug that when you get down and you look at the actual unit of code, you're thinking to yourself, well, this unit of code looks fine. When I run it, it works when it runs in this little piece, but in the system, it breaks. Like, so if I compile it with this compiler, it works fine, but this other compiler doesn't work fine.
Okay.
So it breaks with the different environment or the symptom, and it makes it really hard to figure out what's going on, because it looks like it, if you look real close, it looks fine. But then when you get out, that's where the problem's at.
I see. Interesting.
So if you're trying to look for these kind of bugs, you need to look further away instead of close up. So
yeah, because you'll just look at that really close piece of code and you're like, it's working. Why is this breaking?
Yeah. They had a quote here where it was like, the closer you look, the less you're seeing of the other stuff.
Huh.
Which just makes sense.
Yeah, totally. All right. So the next type of bug is called the Bohr bug.
All right, so the Bohr bug is something that where the bug manifests itself consistently under well-defined conditions.
Such as
like
an Epson printer cannot print on Tuesdays.
Only on Tuesdays or on a leap year. Or, like, for example, and they also often refer to this as like the ghost in the code.
Yeah.
Like it'll work 99% of the time, and then all of a sudden when you use an array that's like X amount of bytes, it messes up. Like, there was this Excel bug that if you used a certain number and added it to another number, it would not add right.
Weird.
It was just weird.
That's bizarre.
So that kind of bug where it's really, really hard to track down.
The ghost in the code.
The ghost in the code.
The next type of bug we want to talk about is the Mandel bug.
So the Mandel bug is one where it's so complex that the bug shows up in such a complex way that you have no idea what was causing it. So, like, it might work sometimes, but not others. But it appears to be so random.
Yeah, it's like the opposite of a Bohr bug. Right. Bohr bug is like this: if you do these specific things, this bug appears every time. The Mandel bug is sort of like, it just the sort of conditions in which the bug appears are always changing, or they seem to be always changing, and so chaotic that it's very difficult to find. All right, so the next type of bug we're going to talk about is called the Schrodinger bug, which is aptly named after Schrodinger's cat.
Experiment.
This is a weird one. I kind of understand it. I don't understand how it can happen. It seems almost like a freaky mental thing, but basically the whole point is that this program is working forever, and then someone looks at the source code and they say, whoa, this program never should have worked, and all of a sudden it breaks for everybody.
Yeah, or it's working, but I'm not sure why, and then they, like, tweak it and it doesn't work or something. Yeah,
exactly.
Is this kind of an example of this? Is this kind of like the Debian SSH key thing, where it's like, man, this shouldn't be here.
This shouldn't work,
and then he changes it and it breaks for everyone.
Yeah, I'm not sure if...
I'm not sure on this one.
Yeah, I'm not sure. So if anybody has a really good example of a Schrodinger bug...
Or the Schrodinger's cat experiment, I'd like to know a little bit more about that. I've heard about it enough, but...
Mm-hmm.
I don't fully understand that.
So, either. Yeah, let us know. I'm curious. I mean, it's funny because every article I look up on this says, it sounds impossible, but this does happen. Well, I want examples then. I'm really curious.
So the next one is the phase of the moon bug. I like the title.
Yeah, is this related to astrology?
No. So, like, this is where the code depends on a certain type of, and this is kind of like the Bohr's bug. It depends on a certain type of thing. A perfect example is, like, year 2000. Yeah. It depends on the 95, 98.
Yeah.
And then you get to 00 and it doesn't work anymore.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
So it depends on some goofy thing.
Yeah. Or it's similar to, I think, maybe it might bleed the lines, but like we're talking about daylight savings time. Mm-hmm. Programs were established knowing that daylight savings time started this day and ended this date. And then Congress went and changed that, and a lot of programs broke.
Right.
For that reason.
Yep.
You know, there's a lot of patches issued because of that.
So it's the phase of the moon bug. The next one is the statistical bug. This is the one where the program might work 9 out of 10 times. One out of 10,000 times. And then all of a sudden, if you run this program many times, mm-hmm. it might show statistical errors. So, like, when you're trying to generate pseudo-random numbers, for example, mm-hmm. over time, you might you might get some
repeats
and things like that. So they give some examples of that. The stir fry function in the new C library, for example, has some statistical biases.
Really?
Yep.
Or let's say, I was just kind of thinking about this off the top of my head, but if you get into sort of these significant number sort of things, mm-hmm. where like the program only calculates like the third decimal percentage, but mm-hmm. it's like the shaving of the percentage of a penny problem banks, you know?
It might work in small sets, but when you start getting a large amount of money or whatever.
Yeah, so, you know, it's like if you take that little shave of a penny and throw it away, it's no big deal. It doesn't really affect anybody's accounting books, but if you throw that shave of a penny into a savings account, after a while it accumulates and gets something. Mm-hmm. You know, something like that.
Yep. In large sets, it becomes an error, but by itself in the little piece.
It's safe and works. Yep. Well, that wraps it up for this episode of Face Off. Again, if you guys have any thoughts, I'm really interested both in the signs that our topics this week, our signs that you're a bad programmer, and our types of computer bugs. I'm really interested to hear what you guys think about some of these. Like I said, I wouldn't say I'm a really good programmer. I try to follow best practices, but as far as really advanced algorithms and things like red, you know, black search trees and stuff like that, I don't know a whole lot about them. So I'm curious mm-hmm. to see what you guys think about that. Being some of you are maybe not as good programmers as us, and some of you are probably a lot better programmers than us. And also some of these bugs. I wonder, you know, if you have some strange stories where maybe some of these bugs occurred to you or something like that, let us know. Just go to faceoffshow.com/feedback. I'm really curious to hear what you guys think.
Or give us a call at 31Web2Tech.
Yeah.
And leave a message.
Yeah, very interested. Also, make sure you can go to faceoffshow.com/subscribe if you want to subscribe to the show if you haven't already. And that's it. Thanks, guys. We'll see you next week. And to play us off this week, here is Alvin and the Chipmunks.
Oh, no. Is that bad?
All right, you chipmunks. Ready to sing your song?
I'll say we are. Yeah, let's sing it now.
Okay, Simon?
Okay.
Okay, Theodore?
Okay.
Okay,